Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRose Show. We have a returning guest joining us today. It's Michael Howell. He is the founder and CEO of Cross Border Capital. He is also the author of the book and the Substack, Capital Wars. Michael is someone who pays close attention to global liquidity, which he points out actually matters more than interest rates. In this episode, Michael explains that we saw a bottom in the global liquidity cycle back in September of 2022. He also notes that it's not a linear path forward, but we are likely to see global liquidity peak out sometime in 2025, so investors beware. According to Michael, this is really important to pay attention to as he thinks the Fed will get a grip on the emerging inflation problem, squeeze the economy, and push investors out of risk assets and back into bonds. But in the near term, there is an opportunity, according to Michael, to stick to markets and maybe get back in at a lower price. He thinks that we could be experiencing a air pocket as investors are paying those tax bills, which are due today as we are recording on April 15th on tax day. I really enjoyed this episode with Michael. I always learn something from him. I love learning about the liquidity cycle. It is so fascinating to me. I know many of you all enjoy it, and I hope you all enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Michael Howell, CEO of Cross Border Capital and author of the book Capital Wars, The Rise of Global Liquidity, and also author of the Substack, Capital Wars. It is great to welcome you back on the show, Michael, and great to see you as always. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Great pleasure to you, dear. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I have to say, Michael, you're a fan favorite, and a lot has transpired in the last 4 months since we last had you on. So I'm really excited to kick things off where we always start, and that is to get our guests big picture, macro view, the framework in which they're looking at the world today. And again, Michael, one of the things about this show is you can take all the time you need to set the table when it comes to that macro picture.
Okay, thank you. Basically, money moves markets. So what we do at Cross Border is track global money flows. And hopefully what you can see in terms of the chart is our chart on the Global Liquidity Index, which shows how the cycle is evolving. And as a quick heads up, what has transpired is that the liquidity cycle bottomed around September of 2022. It's been pushing higher pretty much ever since, but as we've been warning, I mean, it's never a straight line up, and you can see little setbacks on route. But generally, we would suspect that the next peak in the cycle is likely to be sometime around late 2025, and the cycle is evolving, you know, for the most part, as a normal investment cycle. And I think that's very different from the consensual view, which says that it's, you know, a whole lot of bad things are happening. You know, the economy is on the brink of recession, the yield curve is inverted, risk is high, etc. We take a very different view.
I want to explore that further, that different view, because that's interesting to me. You're right. There are a lot of folks who still think we're on the brink of recession. They point to the inverted yield curve and whatnot. What are they missing, or what are they getting wrong? Let's flesh this out a bit more.
Well, I think the first thing is that the focus of most analysis has been on interest rates, and particularly on policy rates. And they really accepted the Federal Reserve line that if the Fed hikes Fed funds rate, as the textbooks tell us, that's a monetary tightening. What they've missed is the fact that actually what really matters, the interest rate that matters maybe rather more in the system, is not the short-term rate, it's more the long-term rate. But even then, the long-term rate is probably trumped by the flows of liquidity in the system. And the reason that we keep stressing liquidity as a driver is that we're in a world that's very different right now. We're in a world that is not about new capital spending. The economy per se is much, much less interest rate sensitive in a general sense than it was probably 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The US economy, for instance, is much more service orientated. Service sector is dominating manufacturing. Not saying manufacturing is unimportant, but it's clearly being dominated by services. You've got a situation where the government is key in the economy. If bond yields go up, that's income for a large part of the community. And so higher bond yields are actually creating income, and that income is being spent. So it's not entirely clear that high interest rates are going to cool the economy in the way that the Fed narrative suggests. So that's, leave that on one side. The reason that liquidity is important is that we're in a world, as I said, not so much about capital spending and, you know, swings in inventory. It's much more now about debt refinancing. We're in a world where there's, you know, $350 trillion of debt in the world economy, and that debt has to be rolled over. It's not perpetual debt. It has a term on it. And, you know, corporations or governments issue bonds for 5 or 10 year lengths. And periodically, those bonds come up for refinancing. Now, if the average maturity of debt is about 5 years, what that means with $350 trillion of debt, $70 trillion has to be refinanced every year. And that's quite an ask for financial markets. And you need financial capacity within the system to do that, which means liquidity. So if you don't get that liquidity, if that liquidity is unavailable, what you get are banking and refinancing crises. And we would argue that look back over the last 20 years or so, and every financial crisis you can think of has always been about a refinancing crisis in some form. Think back to 2008, think back to 2019 with the repo crisis in America, think back to the Asian crisis in 1997. All these are examples of refinancing crises. And that's what the world is about now. It's about getting the right levels of liquidity in the system. Now, that's what the Federal Reserve and the Treasury in the US are really focused on. I mean, I accept the fact that, acknowledge the fact that they'd like to get inflation down. Obviously, they would do. They'd like to create more employment. Sure, they do. But when push comes to shove, what really matters is the integrity of the US Treasury market. And that's what they're really focused on. If there is any wobbles in the Treasury market or any knock-on effects in the banking system, the Fed and the Treasury move with alacrity. And that's what we've seen time and time again. And my view, and part of the reason that liquidity is increasing, is that what you've got are concerns, innate concerns, about the integrity of banks and maybe treasuries. And this is why liquidity is being inched into the system. So that is spilling over and it's starting to push up lots of other asset prices, as we know, Wall Street, crypto prices, gold, etc. And this is not just a short-term phenomenon, it's a long-term phenomenon. And the reason it's a long-term phenomenon is that really what you've got are fiscal finances that are shot through in the West. You've got a situation where government spending is way, way ahead of revenues. The deficit is swinging up at high levels. At the moment, it's 8%. But if you look at the medium-term view of congressional budgets, all this projects, it's slated to run on at 5, 6% of GDP into the medium term. And then you've got to add to that what the interest bill is doing. The interest bill is meaning you're actually taking on debt on top of debt. And you're getting this sort of skyrocketing of the debt-GDP ratio in the US. Now, as I keep saying, you know, we're not hitting on America here. America is the cleanest shirt in the laundry. The rest of the West is a much, much worse situation. Well, what it means is the liquidity is here for the long term for the simple reason that the only way that you can afford this debt is to effectively monetize the debt through printing money. And either that comes through more Federal Reserve buying of debt, in other words, a return to QE policies, which are not far off in my view, or you have to have the banking system itself starting to buy government debt, buying treasuries. And what are you hearing, you know, through the grapevine, that the supplementary liquidity ratio that's been constraining bank holdings of treasuries is about to be relaxed. And you know, these are the sort of things we ought to be looking for. Why does Janet start to fund you know, large amounts of the deficit through bills, not coupon debt? Because it's easier and it's a way of monetizing the debt. Isn't that what the gold market is telling us right now? These are the concerns that are being spelled out. You know, gold started to move well before these geopolitical tensions appeared. And gold is moving because we think of monetary inflation fears.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it's not necessarily the geopolitical, it's the monetary inflation fears. Can you explain that a bit further? That's interesting what the gold market is sniffing out.
Yeah, well, let me put on a chart. I'm going to go right to the end of my presentation, and I'm going to show you a chart which basically looks at gold and crypto as monetary inflation hedges. So here what you have in black, the black line, going back to the mid-1970s, is the profile, the tracking of global liquidity in the world economy. So this is the amount of money that is sloshing through world financial markets. It's what drives asset prices higher, etc. The orange line is the market capitalization, the market value of gold and latterly, over the period since 2015, cryptocurrencies. So you put those two together, and we say that they are monetary inflation hedges. They are protection against the devaluation of paper money, which is what's going on as governments are basically printing more cash. The dotted line at the bottom of the chart is what's happened to U.S. consumer price inflation, in other words, high street inflation. Now, the point here and the key point to take away is that monetary inflation is not the same thing as high street inflation. In actual fact, monetary inflation is a component of high street inflation, in other words, what it costs people to go shopping, etc. But monetary inflation combines with costs to give you high street prices or high street inflation. What that chart tells us is there's been a lot of cost deflation, deflation I'm stressing, over the period to cause high street inflation to shortfall what monetary inflation has done. Monetary inflation drives asset prices primarily. Gold and crypto, as this says, also drives Wall Street. It's not too good for bond markets, but generally, risk assets tend to do well in the monetary inflation environment. But what you've seen through this period is monetary inflation, not high street inflation. Now, monetary inflation can spill over into high street inflation, particularly in an environment where costs are not falling. And that may be the situation we're moving to in the future. But if you look at that black line and roll that on into the future, what you've got is the prospect of significantly further monetary inflation. Now, I want to hold that thought because that's a key one. And I want to go back to, in the chart, sorry, to a little table.
No, no, we love here. It. Keep share all you need.
Here we go. Now, this is U.S. public debt. And I want to stress again, I'm not hitting on the U.S. The U.S. is the cleanest shirt of the laundry. It so happens that the U.S. is extremely transparent with projections. And you wouldn't get this sort of detail from Europe or even Japan in terms of what the future looks like. But this is what the Congressional Budget Office is really slating for the next couple of decades. And what it shows in the graph is the growth rate of public debt as a percent of GDP. Okay, it's not the year-on-year change. It's the growth rate as a percent of GDP. So what you can see is that this is really the burden that the economy is taking in terms of holding public debt. And it's getting heavier and heavier and heavier, and it's skyrocketing. You've got to think why that's occurring. And what the table on the left-hand side is trying to do is to explain that particular issue. And what it's saying is that you've got a primary deficit, so that's before interest payments, that is moving from, if you look at the 1960, 1980, 2000 period, either very, very small deficits or surpluses, there was a surplus in the year 2000, to very sustained primary deficits. In other words, there was a big deficit in 2010 after the global financial crisis. There was a whopping great deficit in 2020 after the COVID crisis. And looking forward, because of the burden of demographic aging, because of Social Security, Medicare payments, and the burden of defense spending, you've got sustained deficits of around 5% of GDP based on Congressional Budget Office, I say that, bipartisan estimates. If you look at the interest payment element, that is also skyrocketing. Now, why is that going up? It's going up curiously because if you go back to 1980, US Treasury yields were close to 15%. So why is it that the interest payment burden in 1980 was so small at less than 2%? Because the debt GDP ratio, column three, was so small. It was only 25% of GDP. Now it's over 100%, right? And even though interest rates are a third of what they were in 1980, what you've got is a debt burden, debt GDP, which is slated to be 10 times what it was in 1980 by 2050. And that's why you're getting this huge, huge burden of debt on the economy. And that's why it's unsustainable in that spend. So it's got to be monetized away. And that means effectively, it means that real interest rates have got to be negative. But more importantly, there's got to be monetization. And therefore, investors need protection against this monetization. And therefore, what you've got to do is to move away from government debt and move much more into monetary inflation hedges, of which gold cryptocurrencies, Wall Street, in other words, you know, good solid companies on Wall Street are some of the best hedges.
Can we go back and explore the monetization of the debt? It sounds like maybe they're effectively already doing that. How that ties into liquidity, and you were just mentioning some of the implications, like staying away from the bond market, moving into other assets. Can you just kind of frame it up for folks, and maybe folks who might not be as familiar with the terminology around, you know, what it means to monetize the debt, what that means?
Well, okay, let me sort of give some examples. I mean, let me say that if you look at the activity of the Treasury, the Treasury has been extremely adept at funding the U.S. deficit. Janet has been great in terms of what she's been doing. And one of the things, that one of the tricks they pulled, and I use it, the trick in inverted commas, is this: they've been doing a lot of funding at the short end of the market. In other words, they've been issuing a lot of bill finance. Now, bill finance, in terms of what that means, is it's selling government paper, government debt of up to 12 months maturity. So it's very, very short-term paper. That paper tends to be very keenly bought in the markets, but generally by credit providers. Now, if credit providers buy government debt, technically, that is a monetization of the debt. In other words, they're effectively expanding their balance sheet, printing money, in other words, to absorb the government debt. And it's something that's, well, I'm not going to say gone unnoticed, but it's largely been uncommented upon. But it's a significant point. If funding occurs at the longer end of the market, in other words, that the government sells coupon debt, in other words, treasuries with a coupon, that 30-year debt, to institutions like pension funds or to households, that is not monetization, that's just a straight debt sale. So it tends to have more benign consequences. Monetization, as we fear, causes inflation. You know, Milton Friedman would be turning in his grave if he, you know, saw some of these figures that are coming out. And if you recall, in a celebrated YouTube interview, Stanley Druckenmiller, the fabled investor, said 6 months ago that the numbers that are coming out of the U.S. Treasury for funding are the numbers you'd expect coming out of a Latin American country, not out of the USA. And that was one of the fears that he spoke of then. And that was, if you like, foreshadowing the likely impact on the gold market of these events. And gold has gone up because gold is a very good historic monetary hedge. And so that's why I'm voicing these concerns, because the situation is not going away. It's permanent.
So, Michael, it sounds to me like it doesn't necessarily look like it's like such a rosy picture for maybe the U.S. economy, maybe more of our fiscal picture, but maybe just because of like the liquidity story, where we are in the liquidity cycle, it's still going to push asset prices up. Is that how that works, or is that how to think about it?
Well, it's certainly a way of protecting against the monetary inflation, because monetary inflation inflates certainly risk asset prices. But the question is, you've got to start to do these calculations more and more in real terms. And one of the ways to think about this, although it's a slightly upside down way of thinking, is to think of the gold price. Now, everybody says, well, the gold price goes up. Actually, that's not quite true. Gold is the pole star in the financial system, and gold stays where it is. Actually, financial assets devalue against gold at different rates. So in other words, what the gold price going up is really telling you that the paper dollar is devaluing against gold. It just so happens that when we talk about it, we say gold goes up rather than the dollar goes down, which is actually a neat way from a policymaker's perspective to understand it. But that's the reality. So gold is something solid, and let's think about that as the benchmark. That is the pole star in the sky that you navigate by. So all we're really trying to say is that some things are going down faster. It simply can't be a zero-sum game if you're issuing all this debt on all this paper money. There is a cost somewhere, and that cost is basically a monetary inflation. And what you need, what I'm trying to say is you need assets you can hedge against that. So whether it's prime real estate, whether it's Wall Street, solid companies, whether it's crypto, you know, I'm not recommending crypto. What I'm saying is that it has demonstrated itself in the last 5 years as being a pretty decent monetary hedge. Gold has been, it's got 2,000 years of history as a monetary hedge. So these are the sort of assets you've got to start thinking about when the public sector starts to derail itself. And that's what's going on now.
So gold has, I take it gold has further to run from even the price moves we've seen of late.
Well, I think unquestionably, because, you know, it's not a major part of people's portfolios. Whereas if you go back to the 1970s during the inflation era there, many of the large institutions would have 5 to 10% of their portfolios in gold. That's simply not the case anymore.
Let me ask you this about like our debt situation here in the U.S. We're north of, I think, about $34.6 trillion the last time I checked. You were also mentioning like the deficits here. What's the end game? Have you thought about that? Do you have that kind of scenario of like, how do we kind of deal with this situation? I know we're the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry pile, but just curious, like, how do you think this kind of plays out?
Well, I think the thing is to start thinking about what this means on a medium term sense. And I'm going to show you another chart, this previous chart. Now, this chart is looking at comparing, and this goes right back to 1800. So it looks at 2.5 centuries of government debt, measuring government debt to GDP. Now, the U.S. data, the orange line, is data that we've taken from the Congressional Budget Office. So again, it's clean data, very believable data, and the gray area is the CBO's projection into 2050. The dotted red line is data we've put on, which is the equivalent data for the British economy. Now, the reason for looking at this is that many economists say once you start getting up to debt levels of 250% of GDP or whatever, it's unsustainable. Well, the problem is that actually what history shows is that it's quite sustainable, but it has very bad economic effects, okay? It's not that debt is going to be, defaulted upon, because governments never default, do they? They'll just print money and they'll find an excuse for doing that or whatever, devaluing your debt. But what happens is, consider Britain in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And Britain got into that mess because basically combined two things at once, fighting a world war and World War II, with also a very generous welfare system that was enacted thereafter. And so the debt-GDP ratio of the UK skyrocketed. Now, if you look at the state of the British economy in the last 50 years, you cannot say that there's been an economic miracle. Rather, the opposite. There's been a secular decline in the health and the performance of the British economy, with maybe a small uplift during the Thatcher years, but generally there's been a long-term decline. And that decline is because of the public sector, of the huge debt burden that Britain had to suffer. Now, if the US goes the same route, that's the concern. Growth starts to be hit and you start to see a slower growth, more troublesome economy, if you like. Japan is there. Japan is seeing debt levels of 250% of GDP. It's quite sustainable for Japan. The Japanese buy the debt. Okay, sure. Japan hasn't defaulted. It won't default. But is Japanese economic performance anything like it was in the 1980s? No. And the risk that you get is you get into these debt situations, economic performance suffers. So what we've got to be very wary of, if we project forward these sort of debt levels, US economic growth will start to come down significantly. It would detrend lower. And that is obviously a major cost. So this is not a happy situation.
Certainly. How about your outlook on the US dollar? I would love to get your take there.
The US dollar, I think, is, let me again say something about the dollar. I'm going to again look at a chart to try and show what's going on. This chart is something to think about very carefully, because what it shows is capital inflows into the US dollar. And you've got the curious situation going on right now where the gold price is going up, but the dollar, in terms of the DXY or Dixie index, the trade weighted index, is also appreciating against other currencies. Now, other currencies, and I made this point when I talked about the US being the cleanest, dirty shirt in the laundry argument, that others are in far worse situation. So it's not surprising in many ways that the dollar is actually gaining vis-a-vis its peers like the euro or the yen, but it's maybe falling against the gold price. And this is showing capital inflows into the US dollar over the, you know, the last 15, 20 years. And what it's highlighting is the fact that since the global financial crisis, there have been huge inflows into dollar assets. And a large part of the reason for that was, first of all, you had the Basel III banking regulations, which actually demanded that banks worldwide hold more safe assets. And safe assets, for the most part, can be considered U.S. Treasury securities. So there was whopping great demand for U.S. Treasuries. Then you had around 2016, the opening up of the Chinese capital account temporarily, so the Chinese could sort of squeeze into the IMF's SDR unit. That was a temporary window of a year. But look at the speed with which capital left China and went into U.S. dollar assets. And then you've had as well the COVID crisis, et cetera, which has caused money to spike back into the dollar. Very, very difficult to argue that the dollar will be weak when you've got these strong capital inflows. And I think this harks back to an episode in the mid-1980s that the celebrated hedge fund manager George Soros coined, a term called the Imperial Circle. And he said that what you've got is a situation of virtuous circle for the dollar, where as the dollar goes up, it creates more demand for itself, and you start to see this sort of period where capital flows, you know, go on the back of capital flows and the dollar keeps rising. So I'm definitely not in the camp that says the dollar goes down against these other units. I happen to think the yen is structurally weak, and I think that the European economic situation is parlous given their lack of energy resources, what's happened to Russia, and more particularly maybe what they're going to have to commit to NATO in the future for defense spending. So I don't think Europe is a happy place at all. But I would say that relative to these peers, the US looks pretty good. And I'd have no problem in suggesting that the dollar as a paper unit is the best one out there.
Before I let you go, Michael, let me ask you about your latest piece that you just published on Substack about the yield curve. I know you and I have talked about it being a flaky predictor. So many folks still point to it as a predictor of a recession. We actually had the creator of the yield curve indicator on the show last year. Would love to get your thoughts on the yield curve and what folks get wrong about it.
Okay, I'm going to switch to a chart and let me just go for that, but I've got to try and dig it out. Now, one of the things that, and this is a somewhat wonkish analysis, so you'll have to bear with me in terms of running through this piece by piece. But what you've got are two safe assets, government-backed safe assets in the US financial system. One is treasury bonds, and the other is agency mortgages. Agency mortgages are really, you know, what are backed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, et cetera, the government-sponsored enterprises, but they're deemed to be safe assets. They're held by foreign governments as safe assets. They're even on the Fed balance sheet as safe assets. So, you know, they're safe. The problem is that if you look at in comparison, is that agency mortgages tend to be of much longer maturity. And to use bond speak, they're more convex. They're much more sensitive to changes in interest rates than conventional treasuries. And so you've got to make adjustments. So what we've done here is that we've technically made an adjustment to try and make the agency mortgage market look like the treasury market. And we've drawn up a synthetic 10-year implied treasury yield from the mortgage market. And that's the black line you see. The orange line is the actual treasury yield. Now, what you can see on the chart, I've gone back here to 2005, are three periods where the orange line falls noticeably below the black line. And that is 2008, the global financial crisis. That is 2020, the COVID crisis. And that is the recent period since mid-2022. Now, what is the reason that you've got this shortfall? I would argue it's because of what's happening in terms of issuance by the Treasury, by Janet, in terms of the calendar of US debt issuance. And the black line on the chart is measuring this spread that you saw here between the orange and the black line. So that differential is what I've labeled yield suppression in black. And the orange line on this chart is the growth rate of treasury bill issuance. So in other words, the growth rate of very, very short-term government paper. In other words, this is a substitute for issuance of coupon debt, which is what the institutions really, really go for normally. When you see big bill issuance, so in other words, when the market is starved of coupons, what happens is that yield suppression starts to be big. And what that means is the market is not getting the coupons it expected. So coupon debt trades at a higher price, i.e. lower yield, than you'd expect. And that's what causes the differential. So whenever there's big bill issuance, you start to see that differential being wide. And what we see, or what we've seen in the last couple of years, is a surge of bill issuance, treasury bill issuance. And now we're starting to see treasury bill issuance coming down. So what you see is the actual treasury yield is moving up to what the implied yield was telling us from the agency mortgage market. In other words, it's moving up towards 5%. And that's happening sort of persistently and remorselessly. Now, what does that mean for the yield curve? Is if you do the math and you say, well, okay, maybe the actual 10-year yield wasn't the honest yield or the true yield. And what we need to do is to make an adjustment for these things, and we use the mortgage market. Now, this is an approximation, and it's, as I say, not precise, because there's many, many things going on. And if you're a mortgage or an agency mortgage trader, you'd be a lot more, you'd want to do this in a lot more detail than I've done. But, you know, hey, this is approximately right, and it gives a flavor. The black line is what the yield, the true yield curve is probably really saying. The orange line is what the actual yield curve has said. Now, the interesting point is that the black line, in other words, my adjusted yield curve, fits the narrative of what's happening in the markets almost exactly. Number one, the yield curve never inverted, okay? And number two, it's been steepening for the last 12 months, consistent with an accelerating US economy now. Now, we're not saying, as a final point, that the yield curve is steepening aggressively, but it has turned, and this is consistent with a gentle but accelerating US economic recovery, not a recession. And therefore, if you'd have used the black line as a benchmark a year ago, you'd have been much more upbeat on the economy and much more upbeat on risk assets than many people were.
I have to say, Michael, I love having you on the show. You are definitely a fan favorite and welcome back at any time. Before I let you go, any parting thoughts that you'd like to leave with the audience and anything that you'd like to plug, including the Substack?
Well, I think if people are kind enough to be interested in the Substack, Capital Wars is how we write up. We write three or four pieces every week about what's going on in markets. I think as a final thought as to what's going on right now, as far as we can see, I think there are two things to say about the investment outlook. Okay. One is that where are we in the medium-term cycle? And I alluded to the fact that the cycle bottomed in September of 22 and it's slated to peak sometime in late 2025. What is behind that peak? It's likely that the Federal Reserve will get to grips with what may be an emerging inflation issue at that time and will want to squeeze the economy and maybe create a recession and force people out of risk assets back into government bonds, because at some time they've got to discipline yields and try and get yields down. Because as you can see from this maths, otherwise it becomes a real, real burden in terms of debt. So beware sometime in late 25, that reaction of a Fed that is on the warpath again. In the near term, there may be an opportunity to stick with markets or get back into markets at a lower price. Because what you're seeing this month and maybe stretching into May is an air pocket in US liquidity. Fed liquidity has risen 10% over the last 6 months or so as the Fed has injected more liquidity than it's fessing up to into markets. But what you're seeing in April and early May is the effect of the tax payment. In other words, tax filings are due on the 15th. Oh, that's today, isn't it, I think?
Which is today, yeah, that's right.
Worryingly. And what you've got is likely a surge of money into the Treasury, which will be pulled out of bank deposit accounts and out of money funds to feed government coffers. So as that money starts to go in, it's sucked out of financial markets, and there may be an air pocket that it will be difficult for the Fed or the Treasury to negotiate near term. So markets may respond to that with a step down. And I think that's not a bad re-entry point for people that want to get back into risk assets. because I think we're still looking at a situation that looks, to my mind, pretty rosy over the next 12, 15 months.
Really fascinating. I love like hearing where we are in the liquidity story. And I love having you on. Michael Howell, founder and CEO of Cross Border Capital, author of the amazing Substack, Capital Wars, and the book. Great to have you on as always, Michael. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, your ideas, all of your knowledge. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Judith. Great pleasure again. Thank you.